you have to take it a step at a time.
Yeah, and I think one question people ask, we were recently on the east side doing some interviews over there, and we saw a lot of good things, but mm-hmm. we also saw a lot of abandoned properties right, and that sort of thing. One step at a time in the neighborhoods, I mean, what does that mean from a practical standpoint? Neighborhood associations, moving people back in, building tiny homes. I mean, how do you get that done?
Well, it's a combination of things. Certainly, you want people to feel safe. So a CB patrol or our experience with the police recently, actually the 10th Precinct, let me give them a shout out, has been excellent. I mean, just much improved from 20 years ago. You need investment. I mean, so within a mile radius of where we're sitting right now, there are 300 vacant lots and 500 blighted buildings. So that isn't just going to go away because we have a CB patrol, although the CB patrol isn't going to hurt because it's going to stop people from squatting and burning buildings and that sort of thing. So an investment, both on the business side and on the residential side.
Well, we read a lot about people like Dan Gilbert investing in buildings and what have you. Is there a similar movement going on with some of these lots and abandoned homes? I mean, do you see some private capital coming in and taking advantage of price right now?
Certainly, there's discussion about what's being sold through the land bank and whether it's going – some is restricted for residents and neighborhoods, and that would be good. But there's enough opportunity for everybody, I feel, right about now. So come on down.
Well, one of the things that, as you know, you could use vacant properties for is urban gardening. And I know you've got an urban gardening program as well. Tell us about that. And is there an expansion of urban gardening going on in Detroit?
There is. There are a lot of organizations, including ours, that are doing urban gardening, which is particularly good for the summer months, obviously. It's Michigan. It's not so good to get you through the fall, winter, spring. And so to either make a living at it or to eat exclusively off it is harder. I guess it's possible. I've read about root cellars and fruit cellars and the rest. But most people aren't at that point currently in the city. There's also been great discussion about large sort of industrial or commercial urban farms. I'm less excited about that just because, you know, I believe you move to a city because of the people, not necessarily farming. Farming is great. We all need food, but I much prefer to see at the community level.
Now, when we talked before, you had just come out with This Far by Faith, 20 Years at Cass Community, mm-hmm. published by the David Crumb Media folks. How's your book? How's it done?
Well, we've sold 5,000 copies, so not too shabby. We're about to bring out a new book this summer called Tiny Homes in a Big City that will detail what we did with our tiny home project and what others have done so that people considering replication would have sort of a guidebook to take them through the process.
Well, again, congratulations on the book, and I would be remiss if I didn't mention it. And I know you don't like people, you know, lavishing praise, but I think in 2016, last year, you were elected to the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame.
Yeah, it was quite an honor. Thank you.
Well, congratulations on that. Any other initiatives coming up that our listeners need to know about? Are there ways that they can get involved with the work that you do?
Sure. We use 7,000 volunteers a year. So if you're interested in coming for a day or a weekend or a week or a month or a year, go to the website, casscommunity.org, and click on that volunteer button. We'd be glad to have you. Or if you'd like to come down and take a tour of the tiny homes, go to the website and send us an email.
Well, it's been a pleasure to welcome back to the program Reverend Faith Fowler. She is the Executive Director of Cass Community Social Services. They're doing some great work down there. And you still have your senior pastor responsibilities. I mean, some things never change.
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
We got them. Detroit. Detroit, Michigan. Heard about Pittsville, USA. We got it. Detroit, Michigan. We got brand.
Current State on WKAR, your weekly radio news magazine taking you around the Michigan Capital Region and across the state. I'm your host, Peter Wharf. Michigan Augusts can be hot and humid. We've had our share of that so far this summer. For some of you who don't like the hot weather, maybe we'll think now about some winter activities to cool you off. We're great here for cross-country skiing, downhill, snowmobiling. The sport of snowboarding was born in Muskegon, Michigan. Native son Sherman Poppin got it all started during Christmas of 1965. Poppin's story is told in the Michigan History Magazine article, How Snowboarding Got Its Start, by historian and Muskegon native Ron Pesch. I got a chance to speak with Ron Pesch by phone about Sherman Poppin's mid-60s holiday brainstorm.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
It was, beautiful Christmas day. The night before, there had been some snow, light powdery stuff. Sherm had two daughters with his wife, Nancy. And, you know, it was a great Christmas. The girls were shouting their pleasure, running around the house. And Nancy happened to be very pregnant at the time. In 3 days, she would give birth to their third daughter.
It's the happiest season of all.
She was wore out and told her husband, take those girls outside and let them run off some steam. And I need to take a nap. So Sherm grabbed his two daughters, took them out, and they wanted to go sledding. They lived out by the lake, by the dunes. The problem was the sled was cutting through the snow, and it doesn't go very well down a hill when it's sand below. So he dashed off to his workshop in the garage and bolted together two kids' skis, brought it out and told the girls to sit on that, and they were able to slide down the hill, but before he knew it, they were standing up on it and having an absolute blast. And that got Sherm to thinking.
He thought about hurtling down the hill with that first vehicle, and that led him to the idea of using a water ski. And before long, his wife Nancy had coined the term snurfing.
Everybody was having a lot of fun with the thing, and Sherm started toying around with ways to improve it. And so the story is that he went and hit all the Goodwills and thrift shops in the area looking for water skis to modify. His dad actually told him to put a rope on the front of the thing so that if you fell off, you didn't have to go chase it down a hill. And the snurfer was born.
Before long, Sherm Poppin was partnering with a slumping bowling manufacturer. A lot of people have heard of Brunswick. What was happening in that relationship?
Well, Sherm was a local business owner. He had a place called Lake Welding here in Muskegon, and he had some friends that worked for Brunswick. The kids in the neighborhood were clamoring for their own version of the board, and so he got with some friends that he knew at Brunswick. As you said, the industry was down in bowling. They were looking for entry into the commercial market. With this toy, they brought up some folks from headquarters in Chicago, took them out to the local country club, and everybody was thrown back to their childhood, sliding down hills on the golf course. And from there, they decided to bring it to market. Sherm trademarked the name. He got a patent for the product. And by Christmas of 1966, which I find amazing considering the way things work today, the snurfer was available in the Sears Wish Book and a variety of others.
How would that early snurfer have compared to today's snowboard?
Well, you know, the big difference is a lack of bindings. It was something you stood up on and you braced yourself against it with that rope. and headed down the hill. So the great thing about it was that, you know, there really was very little expense. That original board sold for around $6, and just like that, you were up and down a hill. But the lack of bindings, of course, created challenges staying on the thing.
And competitions really started, organized competitions, in the late 60s. Tell us about those.
Well, you know, what happened was the local community college had a frat. And those guys decided, wouldn't it be fun to have an international snurfing competition? And they called it that because they had an international student that wanted to compete.
Right. So it became an international competition.
Right. They chose to head out to the state park and host this competition. And around 1,000 folks showed up to watch these guys from the college compete in their championship, guys and gals, I should say. They had their first winners in 1968. In 1969, they opened it up to the public at large, kind of expanded it, created some classifications for younger kids, and it both grew and then shrank from there. Somewhere around 76, actually, the competition had shrunk to relatively few people. It kind of looked like it was going to be the equivalent of the hula hoop. It had its day, and away it went. But one of the things that did occur was that Brunswick decided to get out of the business, and they sold it off to three former employees who had worked on it, and they created GEM Corporation. GEM, in turn, decided to throw some sponsorship money at it. And with sponsorship money came folks interested in competing for those dollars.
And prize money for the competitions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So with those competitions, now all of a sudden the audience grew again. And by 1979, 78, they offered a $1,000 amount for prize money. And split that over the top three finishers, I believe it was. In 1979, the word had spread, and they actually had visitors from far outside of Michigan and West Michigan. They had a gentleman come from Vermont, and his name was Jake Burton Carpenter.
Ron Pesch is a native of Muskegon. We're talking about the development of the snowboarding sport. Born and raised also in Muskegon, Michigan. Tell me about guys like Jake Burton Carpenter and Tom Sims and what they brought to the development of the board and the sport.
Jake Burton Carpenter had just started a business in 77. He called it Burton Corporation. And what he had done was he had received a snurfer when he was a younger kid. He decided to modify the board. And when he showed up in 79, he brought with him his boards. That threw the competition into a bit of a tizzy in the sense that they didn't know there was a competing board out there. Since the GEM was giving them the sponsorship money, they had to make a decision on what to do. The kids in the competition felt that Jake should have a chance to ride, so they split the competition in two and created an open category for Jake to ride in. Jake came away with about $200 in prize money for his visit, but more importantly, he introduced the market to another board. Now, Tom Sims, in a few later years, became a direct competitor to Jake Burton Carpenter's board, Burton Corporation, and his background was in skateboarding. Tom, you know, also is an individual that claimed to create a board in his shop class when he was a kid. And so sometimes you'll see references to the inventor of the snowboard.
Looking at Tom Sims, he sort of looked like that archetypical California skater boy, almost like a Jeff Spicoli from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, sort of that classic look.
He certainly did. And, you know, he was a stunt double in a James Bond movie.
Really?
Really lived quite the life. And really, he had a real strong competition going on with Burton. Burton represented the East Coast faction, shall we say, and Sims, the West Coast group. And it was really quite the rivalry. Sims' probably greatest claim to fame in the area of snowboarding is getting that half pipe involved in the sport.
When you think of surf music, of course, Beach Boys, Dick Dale, is there iconic snurf music or snowboard music?
I don't know that there's really iconic snurf music, but one of the things that showed up in the headlines in those past years, of course, was kind of that tie. Instead of Surfing USA, it was Snurfing USA. And so I guess if there's a theme song, that's the one I would tie to it. But, it's really interesting how the snurfer evolved into the snowboard. And then the biggest reason for the name change was because Sherm Poppin had trademarked the name. To find anything that really ties in musically, other than that Beach Boys tune, that'd be pretty challenging.
Ron Pesch is a Michigan historian and author of the recent Michigan History magazine article, How Snowboarding Got Its Start. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Oh, you bet. Thank you, Peter.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.